Who is our next witness?
Sherilyn Tucker.
Dr. Tucker.
Might I have my psychologist come up here?
Is there any problem with that? I know I told you this morning I didn't want anybody else up here, but we've kind of relaxed our rules.
Sure.
Dr. Tucker?
Yes.
If you'd have a seat for me, please. And raise your right hand. Do you swear that the evidence you will give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
State your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Dr. Carolyn M. Tucker.
Before we start your examination, do we have a... Who is the gentleman that has joined you at the table, Mr. Peters?
Dr. Harry McLaren.
All right. Mr. Henry.
Dr. Tucker, you provided me with a copy of your vita.
Yes.
Is this it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I provided Mr. Peters with a copy of that, and I asked that that be marked and received.
What, is there any problem?
No problem.
Okay. Claimants, what are we up to?
Three.
Why don't you describe for us briefly, if you will, your education after high school?
Okay. I graduated from high school in 1968 and then attended North Carolina A&T State University, which is in Greensboro, North Carolina. There I received a BS degree in psychology. I also spent a summer as a Ford Foundation Fellow at Howard University. The next summer I spent as a Ford Foundation Research Fellow at the University of South Carolina. I graduated in 1971 from North Carolina A&T State University. I went on to the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where I received my PhD in clinical psychology. I came to the University of Florida to do an internship of 1 year, and then assumed a teaching position as a professor at the University of Florida.
Right. And your current position at the University of Florida is what?
Well, I'm pleased to say my current position is that of Distinguished Alumni Professor at the university. I was just selected a few months ago as the first African American and the second woman in the history of the university to receive that honor.
Right. Very good. You have, at my request, done some work prior to today to prepare yourself for your testimony here today. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us what that work is involved?
Well, I interviewed a number of the survivors at your request. I also read the complete report that was done, I think, by three professors primarily from Florida State University, FAMU, and the University of Florida.
Is this Exhibit 1 that Dr. Tucker has read? Okay.
And I also reviewed some of my own research that talked about the African-American family, and the utilization of mental health services by African-Americans. And I thoroughly reviewed post-traumatic stress disorder because the experiences and behaviors that were reported to me in the interviews seemed to be consistent with that diagnosis. So I reviewed what we call in our profession DSM-3R, which means Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, that is used as a guide for psychologists and psychiatrists in terms of trying to classify disorders. So I reviewed that specific classification.
Have you done some research of your own on African-American families in America?
Yes, I have.
Fair amount?
I think a fair amount.
Based upon your interviews with both survivors and their children, I believe there were some children involved, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Have you formed any conclusions with respect to the impact of the incident at Rosewood on the lives of the people that you interviewed?
Yes, I have.
What are those conclusions?
First, let me say that based on the experiences as well as the behaviors or symptoms that were described to me, it seemed as though to me that it was quite clear that those were consistent with what's called post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'd like to try to operationalize that term. When we talk about a post-traumatic stress disorder, we're talking about a pattern of behaviors and symptoms following a very distressing event that is something that's pretty much out of the ordinary. And generally, the consequences are that the person would experience extreme stress, fear, terror, and some feelings of helplessness. And the Rosewood survivors certainly did express those kinds of fears. The other thing is that in terms of the pattern of behaviors that you see following a stressful event, you typically see the persons will experience some types of flashbacks or some past memories. For example, Mr. Evans talked about, you know, hearing dogs barking. And
when you say hearing dogs barking, do you mean later on in life?
He was talking about during the Rosewood experience.
During the Rosewood experience.
Uh-huh. The other thing is that in addition to having recollections of past experiences, is that you'll also typically see some avoidance behavior. And that's avoidance of anything that reminds one of the event, like not wanting to go back to the place of the event. You also will see some avoidance of thinking any thoughts about the event. Really, when I heard the survivors talking about it, I just didn't want to talk about it. I really tried to avoid that significantly. There's also sometimes what we call emotional numbness, that the person will have some difficulty with emotions. Sometimes you see some withdrawal, some suppressing of feelings, and having some difficulty in forming interpersonal relationships with others. And then lastly, very often what you will see is what we call extreme alertness or hypervigilance, for example, where there's some concern of a fear, a threat that something could happen. And very often parents, for example, and I can later comment on this, tend to be overly protective of their children, as a for example. In terms of some of the common stressors that produce this disorder, they generally are threats to one's physical self, if somebody's threatening to shoot you or to hurt you or to beat you, or threats to a significant other that you care about, or an event that involves a sudden loss of community, and this is specified in the DSM-3R, or if you experience someone who in fact has been hurt significantly, or for example, seeing somebody who has been beaten or somebody who is significantly injured in a car accident, for example, all of those things can in fact cause post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, with regard to the specific kinds of impact, we usually try to look at the impact on one's occupation, the impact it was with regard to success attainment. Did the experience in some way deter one's success attainment or impact on their occupational performance? We also tried to see whether or not there's any impact on, say, for example, their parenting. We talked about practical functioning. Parenting would fall into that category. Also to see whether or not there was any emotional impact and to see if there's any impact with regard to social functioning. So as I thought about the, as I talked with the survivors of Rosewood, I tried to put the information that they gave me within those constructs. And let me just talk about that a little bit.
All right.
Okay. With regard to the impact on occupation, one of the things that several things came out in our that I think is related to this issue. One is that both Mr. Evans and Mr. Goins talked about their parent. Let me take them one at a time. Mr. Evans talked about his grandfather owning a store. He was living with his grandfather at the time, his grandparents at the time of Rosewood. And so he saw as a role model one who is an employer as opposed to being an employee. Mr. Goins talked about his family being business persons, that they ran a, they owned and operated, I mean his father owned and operated, I think it was a turpentine mill, if my memory serves me well, and I think he also had a small store. And so again, what he saw as a role model was that of a business person, someone who had power and status, and I'm saying power and status within the confines of that particular community. And so traditionally what happens, if you look at so in terms of social learning theory, our aspirations and our are influenced by our role models, and typically for African Americans, either their parents or teachers or other significant ones in their lives provide are the role models. But what happened, and then I would look at then what happened to these gentlemen, for example. So I asked about their careers, and Mr. Goins talked about being a bootblack. And I got an education in the interview because I didn't know what a bootblack was. And so that's one who shines shoes. And Mr. Evans talked about having a number of jobs, all of which were blue-collar jobs that he had worked in a number of different places, from being a cab driver to just a number of jobs that did not involve any formal training. And so they then ended up not being in jobs that have that traditionally have power and status. They worked for other persons as opposed to operating a business. Mr. Goins, I remember saying with pride that, I don't know if he's, I'm going to make sure I get this accurately, but I remember him being very proud when he talked about his parents. And I was told, I think later by his daughter, that and some other persons, that his father had, I think, 60 employees and also provided a place for these employees to live. So what I saw is that Rosewood, at least one would reasonably conclude, disrupted the passing down of the tradition where perhaps they would have inherited it, the business, or certainly did something similar in terms of being, in terms of having power and status and not working for someone. I think also in terms of, let me just move on and talk a little bit about the impact with regard to parenting. To me, that was most interesting because what I saw as I listened to them is they talked about not talking to their children about Rosewood and that it was something that really kept quiet and they didn't want, that it was real hush-hush. And so when you I also heard real overprotection, and I got a better sense of that in talking to Dr. Shafia, who is the daughter of Mr. Goins, and she talked about the fact that her father would not let her sleep overnight with a friend, that he, or to do anything, that he was just very, very concerned, very, very overprotective. I think that in terms of, and with regard to parents, one of the things that happens in African-American families is that there typically is a sharing between parents and children of the past. There are discussions of the good things that happened in the past, and there are discussions of things that are not so good that happened in the past. And when you hear the good things, you get a sense of pride, and it facilitates self-esteem, and it gives you some sense of empowerment. You know, you feel really proud of your heritage. And that's particularly important for African-American families because we're often that you're not going to get it anywhere else, okay? And so the other thing is when you hear about the bad things, then that gives you a sense of appreciation of your parents' survival and also that you can endure, that they endured hardships and you can endure hardships. So I think it facilitates your sense of inner strength that's necessary to deal with whether it's racism or to deal with not getting a job that you knew that you were qualified for those kinds of things. Well, that oral tradition in terms of Rosewood did not get passed on. And so, and when that sharing happens, it forms bonds. The bonding in the family comes from those, the sharing of those real important family life experiences. That didn't happen, and very often what you will see is some it's one of the DSM-3 categories, is estrangement, some emotional estrangement, some detachment as opposed to the real close bonding. And I, in talking with Dr. Shakir, that was one of the points that she also mentioned. And I thought it was quite interesting when she talked about Mr. Doctor, who is, I think, the nephew of Mr. Goins, that he perhaps knows her father more close, more intimately than she does, even though she lived with him, you know, her entire child life and adolescence.
So in your opinion, did the effects of the Rosewood Massacre also affect negatively the children of the people who were there?
I certainly think that it has some negative impact in terms of the parent-child relationship, in terms of disrupting some of the closeness. And I think another thing that comes to mind in terms of the parenting, Mr. Goins, and perhaps Mrs. Goins, I think Mrs. Goins shared this, and I can be precise at any point that you want me to look through my notes. But she was saying that Mrs. Goins was saying that she very often went out to social activities, whereas her husband instead would stay home with the children. And traditionally in African-American families, you would see the mother who would be home taking care of doing the child caring and those kinds of things, and usually the father who would do more of the going. And instead, he felt so strongly about being home with his children and very protective. I think that's another example in terms of how all of this impacted in terms of parenting. Thirdly, let me just move to the impact emotionally. I try to pay attention to not only what was said to me verbally in interviews, but as I generally think of myself as an excellent clinician, so I try to also pay attention to the nonverbal cues. When we started talking about Rosewood, initially, Mr. Glenn was pretty laid back and relaxed in his chair. When I asked him then more specifically about what happened at Rosewood, and if he could just describe that for me, you know, I saw him sit up, and he really talked a lot. I mean, I saw a lot of affect. It was quite emotional and intense about what happened as he described the events. So he talked about not having any anger toward white folks or hatred, but at the same time, I could see that he had anger when he as he talked about the event. And one of the things that we know is when that anger doesn't get expressed, that it can be turned on the inside when it's pushed down. Anger is manifested as depression. Who's the father of cognitive psychology, talks a lot, and the father and the person has done the leading research in terms of depression. And if you look at the DSM-3R, depression and anxiety are two associated factors with post-traumatic stress disorder. The other thing is one of the reasons why, in terms of this issue of anger and hurt and pain, that one of the characteristics of post-traumatic stress disorder as well is that you push it down, you deny, you have what you call emotional numbness. You don't want to deal with it. That's one thing I think was happening. But the other thing is that you would find, in terms of African Americans, and especially older African Americans, feel that you're not going to get to heaven if you go with malice and hatred in your heart. So when you talk about whatever the abuses they have had, you know that you try to deal with that. At least you try to say not have it in your heart, and you try to put that behind you. And my sense of Mr. Goins, Mr. Evans, Mrs. Jenkins, is that they're all religious people. And as a matter of fact, we talked a lot about that when I met with them, that they are very religious, and I think that's one of the reasons why you wouldn't have them talking about hating whites and being really angry at this point. Also, in terms of the emotional impact, it seems like one of the characteristics when we talk about the disorder is having some difficulty modulating feelings, and that you put those feelings down, but sometimes they would just come out immediately, depending on a particular situation. There were two things that came to mind that made me conclude that this also was one of the that this occurred in terms of this difficulty with feelings and modulating those feelings. One was Mrs. Goins shared with me an experience where a situation where a neighbor came over to her house, and this was a white or Caucasian neighbor, and she had invited this person over to get some meat that she had cooked. I think she said Mr. Glenn didn't eat, I don't know if it was pork or beef or something like that. And that he was just very upset that this person was in his house. And she even went on to say that kind of emotional reaction led her to actually talk to his sister as to what might cause this to happen. And that's how she began to find out about Rosewood. And it's interesting because as I talked about that, I just had a flashback. And it was that it seemed as though it was just so shocking to me that after 50 years of marriage, that they had never, Mrs. Goins told me that Mr. Goins had never talked to her about Rosewood. Now, that kind of sharing would typically happen in a relationship. And now, it is true that for African American men, and for men in general, sharing of feelings is not as easy and doesn't occur as frequently as that type of sharing occur among women. But when you're talking about significant aspects of the family events and occurrences, those kinds of things do get shared as part of the oral tradition. That had not happened in their family. And I just found that just unbelievable. and so after 50 years.
You don't mean it was not credible. You mean that it was remarkable.
Remarkable. And I did double check that. I mean, I also asked Mr. Goins, and he said no, he did not share that. So I thought that was, and it's consistent with this kind of either emotional numbness or just, you know, suppressing or denying the feelings and putting that behind. I think the other thing let me just address the other point, because I'm sure other things I will be addressing as I go along, and that is the impact socially. And here, too, was another thing that I found quite amazing, and that is that Mr. Goins had never been in his neighbor's yard until about 2 months ago, living in a neighborhood. And that's very consistent with this idea of estrangement from others, which is very characteristic of post-traumatic stress disorder, that very often persons have difficulty forming interpersonal relationships. And what's associated with that is lack of trust. And one of the things that Mr. Goins and Mr. Evans said very clearly is that they did not trust Caucasians. They did not say they hated them. They did not trust them. And so what you have then is that they did not form interpersonal. It seemed like there's some difficulty in terms of forming interpersonal relationships. And the fact that Mr. Goins does not interact with the people in his community, which my understanding now is a predominantly Caucasian community, I thought that was quite remarkable. Now you could say, well, isn't it true that African Americans in general maybe don't trust Caucasians? And I think that for many that is in fact the case. Yet they would not let that lack of trust deter them from forming relationships that would in fact be beneficial. If it, you know, we use the term in the business world or in the academic world, networking, that you would do, if it's going to be beneficial to you, then you will form those relationships. You may be cautious, but you will establish those relationships. And my sense is that he, in fact, did not do that.
Well, what effect does that have on parenting skills, if any?
Mm-hmm. What?
The inability to form those relationships with Caucasians.
Well, in terms of parenting, one of this makes me think of a situation that one of the children, Mr. Arnett, doctor, shared. He was saying that his parents were so fearful of his mother, this particular person that he talked about, was so fearful of Caucasians that she would she would step off the sidewalk I'm not sure if they had sidewalks, but he used the term sidewalk or off the top, moved to the side of the street so that Caucasians could pass, and that he was cautioned not to say anything, to get out of their way, to be quiet. So what he saw was a lot of fear and association with Caucasians, which he felt impacted him in terms of his being able to interact with Caucasians that could be beneficial, which thus impacted on his occupational success. But more importantly, in terms of the parenting, I think that then influenced that impacted in terms of the children. And you clearly saw the message that was taught, that was conveyed to the children, their own fear that projected to the children. And in terms of social functioning, the other thing is that the community is, community and family, a very important social support, sources of social support for African Americans. Now, what I saw happen in terms of Rosewood is that you have the community completely demolished, disrupted, and so and everybody talked about people went everywhere. And that there was a lot of moving around. You know, there was immediately people dispersed in all different directions, and then subsequent to that, they moved around to a lot of different places. So consequently, there was not this a lot of family and friends around. Now, traditionally, you would get your support from your community and from your family. As a matter of fact, there was a study by Dr. Manning that was published, I think, in 1988 with older, I think the subjects were ages 40 to 65. And in her study, she showed that family members, in terms of the question was, who were your support providers that led to your occupational success? And these were all successful persons that she interviewed. And 80% of the interviewees said family members were support. But interestingly, 64% said community members were their significant support that led to their occupational success. So what we are having here is a community support who were not there. And I also want to mention one thing about the church that I have to think about, is that traditionally, the church has played, and still does, play a major role in terms of African-American families and the community. This is where very often you develop your social skills, you learn your public speaking from presenting in church, etc. And so then you had the church also destroyed in terms of Rosewood, which is a very important socialization agent and also skill-building agent for African Americans. So then you could say, well, okay, they lost their church, they lost their school, they lost their community, they lost significant family members. Couldn't they simply, you know, with a little bit of time, reestablish those things? Well, it takes a while to reestablish significant relationships like that. And so in terms of getting that the kind of support that traditionally comes from community, I didn't see that as being immediately available, and I think that's why you saw some of the, like in Mr. Gowen's, not having a lot of interpersonal comfort, some social withdrawal. So I think, if I need to give other kinds of examples, but I think clearly the social functioning was impacted by Rosewood. Now, I also wanted to say one other thing that I think is important. I think it would be ludicrous and irresponsible for me to say that all of their ways of being how they are now can be attributed to Rosewood.
Is there a way that's accepted in your profession for you to rank this effect or these four factors in terms of I think you call them
psychosocial stressors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Okay. Well, those are any kind of stressful events, as we talked about, threat of physical injury or threat of harm to significant other, etc. Those are psychosocial stressors. Now, typically, when we make a classification or a diagnosis, we talk about the level of severity of the psychosocial stress. And there's a scale, I think it goes from 1 to 6, and with 5 being severe. I can double-check that, but I think 5 being severe stress, and 6 being catastrophic. Now I would rank...
Let me just show you.
Sure.
The table and reduction of value, is that what you're referring to?
Well, this is a revision of it. The scale that we use, let me refer to my notes so I can be more specific. That's similar. I want to make sure that I give you completely accurate information. Okay. It goes from 1 to 6, and 1 means there's no significant psychosocial stress. And
how is that characterized? Does they characterize it with a single word or two? 1?
Well, 1 equals none, okay, meaning no significant stress. Then you can have 2 is mild stress, 3 is moderate stress, 4 is severe, 5 is extreme, that's the one I did not get correctly, and 6 is catastrophic. Now, if I had to talk about the impact of Rosewood and try to evaluate the psychosocial stress, I would look at the 5 and 6 categories. I use the term significant because I always have a problem with these rating scales. And to be completely honest, even though these are standard measures, they're used by most or all licensed psychologists and psychiatrists. Again, you know, it's always some subjectivity.
Yeah.
But given that, I would think that the impact of the Rosewood, based on the individuals that I saw, would fit the 5 or 6 rating, which is extreme or catastrophic.
And why do you conclude that?
The reason is because if you look in the DSM-3R, it gives examples of the kinds of things that would, the kind of stressors that would get that classification. And the stressors that are given involve, both of those involve death. Death of a significant other, death of a spouse or a loved one. The others do not involve. It's nothing as severe as death or experiencing a catastrophe or loss of somebody who is significant. To give an example to make that more clear, if you were going to give us a rating of severe, which would be a 4, you're talking about something like divorce would classify. So, you know, anybody who's experienced a divorce or knows somebody who has, that's pretty stressful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's not the same thing as experiencing the loss of someone who is significant.
All right. What about the loss of an entire community and loss of a lot of significant others, et cetera, has happened in Rosewood here? What's that do to your rating or your scale?
Again, we're talking about the 2 extreme impacts in terms of extreme or catastrophic. And if you ask, well, why, how can I justify that? Because I hate making statements unless I can justify them. And if you look at the DSM-3R, it talks about significant loss, unexpected loss of a community and significant others. And that is considered a significant psychosocial stressor. That is a common one that causes post-traumatic stress disorder. It's spelled out.
To what extent does the deliberateness or the intentionality of the act impact on this?
Mm-hmm. In terms of disasters, according to DSM-3R, you can have accidental disorder disasters that can cause post-traumatic stress. Accidental disorders like a severe car accident, or you can have natural disasters, and those would be something like a volcano or a earthquake where there's loss, or you can have a deliberate disaster where there is terror, people who go to Vietnam, the Jews and the Holocaust. Those are where there's, it's stated in DSM-3R, disasters by human design,
mm-hmm.
meaning it was someone planned it,
mm-hmm.
it was intentional pain.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say then that the pain that we're dealing with here is similar to pain experienced by men and women in Vietnam and men and women in the Holocaust?
I would definitely think so.
To what extent is it fair to generalize from the people that you interviewed, or to what extent, I suppose, would it be reasonable to expect that this symptomology would appear in all of the other Rosewood victims who survived?
Well, based on DSM-3, are that any human being would experience the kind of stress, the kind of events that we've talked about, would have some level of trauma, and that level can be from mild to severe, and that severe stress would result in, from stressors that were deliberate, like the Rosewood situation. Now, and so I would, so it would be my best clinical judgment that anyone would be significantly impacted. Now, the issue is, how does that impact get made things that, you know, that are painful memories?
For there might be variances in the memories.
Exactly. And you also might have some persons who you can see it clearly in terms of their social functioning. Others you may see it clearly in terms of the impact of their occupational. Some people may never form bonds or family relationships. They may move around a lot, you know, and whereas other people may have more stable lives and form family relationships, but they may be impacted. You see it in their social interactions. So they can, so the type of stress that gets manifested can vary across individuals in terms of what you see. And also the timing. With some persons, you may see a more immediate impact in the earlier years of their life. Others, you might see it years later. That's one of the interesting things about post-traumatic stress disorder, is that there are a lot of people who would appear symptom-free for years and years and years. Okay, but the DSM-3R is very careful in saying, however, it doesn't mean that they are not feeling the impact, but it's suppressed, it's denied, there's psychic numbness or emotional numbness.
Well, what's the rule of denial here, and where if at all, did you see it manifested?
Well, I can go by my clinical judgment in terms of what I saw. Is that, well, two things. One, I remember when I first asked Mr. Evans, tell me what happened in Rosewood, what do you remember? And he said, oh, I don't remember much. I don't know if he said anything or much. And then I said, well, you don't remember anything? And then later he paused and he said, well, dogs barking. I remember those dogs barking. And so, you know, that's very characteristic of someone with post-traumatic stress. You know, it's real painful for them to bring those memories, and they're really pushed down. So I saw that, you know, very, very clearly there. And I should also say, in terms of the denial, the constant phrase is, I don't want to talk about it. I just don't want to talk about it. Heard that a lot from all three of the immediate survivors of Rosewood, which is very characteristic of a denial syndrome.
What's the what are the difficulties that people experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder have to overcome in order to confront what happened to them?
Well, typically, one needs to experience psychological counseling. It will go in to see a therapist, and it's usually, even with a professional therapist, that it takes time. It's not one of those short-term therapy deals. That's long-term therapy to be able to get in touch with those memories. Sometimes it involves hypnosis as a vehicle for bringing those memories from the subconscious to the conscious mind.
What's the extent of participation in mental health therapy by African Americans in America?
It is very, I use the term in my own research, underutilization, and that's a mild term.
Why is that?
Typically, African Americans, and particularly low-income African Americans, and most of us fall in that category, do not seek professional counseling. When I did a large study in New York, and it involved 97 African-American families, mostly low-income, the low-income skewed distribution, I think that it was only 94%, I think, had never been to see a psychologist or a mental health professional. And then I wondered about that. I said, well, you know, that's low-income skewed distribution. So one of my graduate students and I did a study with teachers in Alachua County, and there were about 343 teachers in the study, and about one-third of those were African-Americans. And so we're talking about now a more homogenous group and who definitely were not low-income, so they were, I guess you would call lower middle class in terms of teachers. And one of the questions on the questionnaire was, you know, whether or not you had ever been to see how do you feel about seeking mental health counseling? And there wasn't a whole lot of difference between African Americans and Caucasians. But then when I asked, how many of you actually had sought professional counseling, it was significantly more Caucasians than African Americans. And it was a very small percent. If my memory serves me well, it was maybe around 8 or 9%, a very small number of African Americans who would have the funds to be able to seek professional counseling. So typically they would not go. And the other thing that was interesting, the question was in the first study was, if you had a problem, a personal problem, for which you felt you need help, who would you go to for help? And I should say I conducted all 97 interviews. And the general response was that I would go to my minister, or I would go to a family member or a very close friend. And most often it was a minister or a family member. So it was not to go to a mental health professional. And one of the things that I wrote about in the article that actually got a lot of attention is when I asked a question about what is your conceptualization, and I didn't use that term, I said, when you hear the term mental health, mm-hmm. what do you think of? And these persons immediately gave me responses consistent with illness. They said, I think about being crazy, hearing voices, I said mental health. But as soon as you hear the term mental, you talk about mental health professional, then you're talking about you have to be crazy, you know, to seek mental health counseling in terms of the first study. So it seems as though, and then when I looked at it in a different way with a more middle class sample of teachers, I asked them, what kinds of problems would you go to seek help from a mental health professional, including a psychologist or a psychiatrist? And the Caucasian teachers gave a range of problems. If they had a child with a behavior problem, if they had, if there were alcoholism in the family, if there was family conflict, all of those were reasons to go to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist. The African-American teachers instead say, well, if the person was acting crazy or, you know, doing something bizarre, then I would probably seek counseling. Whereas the things like alcoholism or a behavior problem in terms of a child manifesting behavior problems, those were not things that you would seek professional counseling for.
Okay. So if the Rosewood survivors had never sought mental health therapy, that would be consistent, in your view, with what you expected?
Exactly, yes.
One moment, please.
Could I get some water?
Sure may.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dr. Tucker. That's all I have right now.
Yes. How many more? How many are you going to try and do today?
5:30.
Well, no, I told you we have till 5:30. Yep. My problem is we have committee notices that we have got to file, and I need to take a few minutes at some point to do our judiciary work. Okay. So I don't know how much time Mr. Peters wants with Dr. Tucker. This may be a time for a little break.
Thank you.
If that's acceptable to everybody. Dr. Tucker, are you on a time frame? Do we
No.
need to get you home? Okay. Why don't we take a little break, and who else do we have for this afternoon?
Arnett Doctor and Annette Secure.
Does that present any problems with them? Are they going to be here till 5:30? Did they
Yes.
plan their day that way?
They
Okay.
did, thank you.
Okay, why don't we give us about 15? We'll need about 15 minutes to get our notices filed.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.